Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 719, interview with Philippe Carcenti about the Aldura case. This program is being recorded on July 25th of the year 2010, and it is my honor and privilege to bring to our airwaves Philippe Carcenti, who is a French media critic and has come to be a focal point for an investigation into the realities of the Aldura case. Philippe, welcome to our airwaves.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
I'm embarrassed to say, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Perfectly.
Alrighty. Well, yours is a name. This is actually something of an entree point to the substance of our discussion. Your name is not exactly a household word. One doesn't hear it. I have read it a number of different times in a number of different places, but one hears comparatively little about it, at least in the electronic media here in the United States. On the other hand, the situation of the individual whose case you have investigated, Mohamed Aldura, the allegedly or perhaps real late Mohamed Aldura, his name literally became something of a household word. And beyond a household word, it became a political emblem, and I think one could even perhaps say something of a political ammunition for the Islamist cause in the early part of this decade. Philippe, tell us about your professional background and sort of what is the backstory to this case. How did you come to be an investigator or critic of the investigation of the Aldura case?
Well, I'm 44. I used to be a stockbroker. I used to be in business. And when it happened, when the news report of France to the French public TV was aired, it was almost 10 years ago. I was just a regular citizen, had nothing to do with the media. And, well, I was shocked because everybody in the world was shocked by this picture, you know, showing a boy dead, killed by the Israeli soldiers.
You know what, Philippe, let me interrupt ever so briefly, probably before. Explain what the Aldura case is. Now, the reason being that this was 10 years ago, the 10th anniversary is coming up, and younger listeners, people in college now, may not remember this. So that's a little bit about your background, but in explaining your background, also fill in what the Aldura case is, because that may be completely mysterious.
Okay. So on September 30, 2000, the French public TV aired a news report of 50 seconds showing a young Palestinian kid in his father's arms, and the French TV station said that the Israeli soldiers shot and killed the boy intentionally. And it was a tremendous picture, very important, it was very big. It became very quickly an icon of the Muslim world. They made postage stamps out of this picture. They made monuments, buildings, squares. Even Daniel Pearl was killed to avenge Mohamed Aldura. You can see it on the videotape of the killing of Daniel Pearl. It was the beginning of the second Intifada. It was the trigger. It triggered the second Intifada. And it was a year before 9/11. And what we've seen on the internet is that Bin Laden used the Mohamed Aldura pictures to incite during the year before 9/11. So it's a very, very important picture. And it has been used really to incite the Muslim world against Israel, the Jews, and the Western world. And in 2002, a German TV came out with a documentary saying, wait a minute, the boy was not killed by the Israelis, he was killed by the Arabs. So everybody was surprised, and we tried to have this documentary aired in France. But the French public TV didn't want to air it, and private TVs didn't want to bother the public TV. So we were really fighting against them, and all of a sudden, 6 months later, we got information from Israel showing us that the picture were not only not the truth, but they were completely staged. It was actors. They were actors playing. The boy was not killed. The father was not shot. So it was a real shock, you know. We were really disturbed. We were a little group, and I investigated further. And when I understood it was really completely staged actors, I decided to make a big fight and to go after the French public TV to force them to admit the fraud.
Now, for the listeners, because the vast majority of our listeners are not familiar with French TV stations, and we will be talking about more than one during the course of the program, Philippe. The main station that was your adversary in this, initially at least, was France 2, correct?
Yeah, it belongs to the state, and it's controlled by the state, and the president of this TV is appointed by the French president. So it's a really, it's like you had Voice of America, it's Voice of France, you know.
So this is actually a part, of the French government and subject to, from a personnel standpoint, and obviously to a certain extent, therefore, for a policy standpoint, is subject to the control, at least up to a point, of the French executive branch of government.
Yeah, and it's really it's a blood libel, you know, and it was a state-sponsored blood libel, so it was really shocking. I mean, for all the people in the world to see that the French government was sponsoring and paying and defending and promoting such a blood libel was such a shock.
Philippe, let me pause just for a second, too, and again, I apologize. If it seems awkward to try to bring some of this down to the level of a young American radio audience, but the term blood libel, and later on in our program, we're going to be talking about French and perhaps European anti-Semitism, but that is a term that has a very specific and deep historical meaning for the Jewish community and the European Jewish community in particular. Before proceeding with the Aldora case and your situation with France 2, and what is blood libel? And explain, give that phrase a little more historical depth for a younger audience.
Yeah, I understand. I'm sorry for this. Well, blood libel, you know, during the Middle Age, the Jews were accused of killing Christian children to kill the kids and take their blood to make matzot. So this was what we call blood libels 5 centuries ago. And the accusations of Jews killing children was very important in the French, I would say, subconscious. You know, it's really something which is still appears. You know, every time, you know, they always accuse the Jews of killing children. You know, it's always the same thing, you know. So it's a very, it really appealed to the same kind of feelings, you know. The Jews are killing children just either for the pleasure or for their matzot, you know, which was completely absurd.
Now, back to the Aldora case. This fraudulent document was broadcast by France 2, and you, a young professional, decided to challenge this. In particular, there was a case, some of the flaws in the case came out in a German media account in 1982. How did you proceed with France 2? You ultimately wound up in court with them. Develop the story of your legal struggle with France 2.
Yeah, well, the thing is that after I saw the first German documentary in 2002, then after that, we investigated and we understood, thanks to other Israeli people who found the truth, that it was staged. So when we realized it was staged, I went to all, you know, I was a French businessman. I was very connected, so I tried to have, I met all the presidents of the French TV. I said, look, admit the fraud, apologize for this. And nobody wanted to do that. And I understood that the French political system was defending the blood libel. So 2 years later, in 2004, I realized I didn't have a standing to sue them because I was a nobody, you know. I went to the Israeli embassy, asked them to ask the French government for apologies, and they say, we're not interested. You're completely, you're a nut case. We're not even going to discuss with you. So as I was sure that it was really a fake document, I decided to take lawyers, and we decided to provoke France too. So
just one second, Philippe. So you approached the Israeli embassy, and they would not have anything to do with the case?
No, they were not interested.
And okay, the reason that I bring this up is that invariably anyone who undertakes a critique and an effort such as you have undertaken is going to be labeled as either a direct or indirect tool of Zionism and the Israeli government, etc. That's why I bring that point up and emphasize it. Proceed, please. Your next step was?
Well, and I, you're right. And I was accused of being an agent of the Mossad. a secret agent, you know, so they were really the most ridiculous accusations against me.
By the way, Philippe, I am actually the head of the Council of the Learned Elders of Zion, so you're an exalted company here. Philippe, your next step after being rejected by the Israeli embassy.
Okay, so the Israeli embassy rejected me, so as just a private individual, I decided just to engage in a fight with friends too, but I couldn't sue them. So I published an article where I wrote that the France 2 news report was a blood libel, was a hoax, and I said, if you want to sue me, here is my exact address, please sue me. It was a real trap, you know, because we wanted to engage in a fight, and they really fell into the trap. They sued me for defamation. So 2 years later, we had the trial. It was in 2006. I brought some of my evidence. On their part, France didn't bring any evidence. He just brought a letter of Jacques Chirac. At that time, he was the French president. And he wrote a letter saying that the French journalist who was responsible for the news report was a very reliable journalist and that he was a very good journalist doing properly his job. I want to insist on something. This journalist, his name is Charles Enderlin. He's a French-Israeli Jew. He met Aliyah 40 years ago. So he had a lot of credibility, you know. He's as a French Israeli Jew who met Aliyah, he couldn't have been accused of being anti-Semite. You understand what I mean? So it was really tough to fight this guy.
By the way, let's just spell out. You know, I'm going to spell out your name and Mr. Enderlin's because these are names many may not have heard, and undoubtedly there will be people who simply after having heard the broadcast, even before the printed description is up, will want to do an internet search. Philippe, spell your own name, please.
My name is K-A-R-S-E-N-T-Y.
All righty. First name, Philippe. And Charles, of course. And spell your adversary's name.
As a French way, you know, which is P-H-I-L-I-double-P-E.
Correct.
Only one L and double P.
Okay. One L, two P's.
Exactly.
All righty. Now, spell your adversary's name as well, because...
So it's Charles.
Right.
Charles, like Charles. Enderlin. E-N... D-E-R-L-I-N.
All righty. So those are the two principals, my guest, Philippe Carcenti, and his opponent, Charles Enderlin, yes. Who was an Israeli Jew.
He's still a French-Israeli Jew, and he's very connected in Israel, and he has lots of support there. So at the trial, as I said, I brought my evidence, and they just brought a letter of Jacques Chirac. At the end of the trial, the government advisor, in French we call it Procureur de la République, advised the judge to say that I couldn't be found guilty of defamation because I brought enough evidence that it was staged. But a month later, on October 2006, I was found guilty of defamation. I think we could say that there was a huge political pressure on this verdict.
Can you repeat what you just said, Philippe? Because I that's stunning to me. Repeat that, please, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, I said that the government advisor said that I shouldn't be found guilty of defamation because I brought enough evidence that it was staged. But a month later, I would say after, I think, a lot of political pressure, especially since we had the letter of Jacques Chirac against me,
mm-hmm.
I was found guilty of defamation, and it was a real shock because, I couldn't expect that.
Sure,
so
sure. I have a question about French judicial procedure. You say government advisor. Now, is that the state prosecutor or what? How would he figure into the trial?
Sorry?
How would that government advisor figure into the trial? Does he have weight with the judge? Is he what we in America would call a prosecutor or a district attorney?
The same thing. He represents the interest of the society.
Uh-huh.
And he's, after having heard me, my lawyer, their lawyer, and read all the documents.
Mm-hmm.
He gives his opinion as the justice. You know, he's
the judge.
He's kind of no, he's not a judge. You know,
because
the judge then came later.
Okay.
And three judges decided that I was found guilty of defamation.
Oh, I see. So he oversees the presentation of evidence, and
exactly.
Then a three-judge panel makes the decision.
Exactly.
Okay, see, that's what I wanted to clarify. Okay, so basically the person, the government official overseeing the trial says he can't be found guilty of defamation because he's presented enough evidence that it's true, but then a month or so later, the three judges, they're like the three fates of Greek mythology, hand out a different verdict.
Yeah, exactly. So they found me guilty of defamation. I was at the court. I stayed in the building. I said, I want to appeal. My lawyer said, you can wait. Wait a minute. I said, no. It's unacceptable. So I stayed in the building. I couldn't leave the building until I appealed. So I went to the room when I had to appeal. I appealed the verdict. And then instead of, having my life, you know, when keeping on working on other, on focusing on some other media frauds, I decided just to focus on Mohamed Abdelrahouf and work 100% of my time. So I've been traveling all over the world to gather more evidence, more professional advice, and we had the trial a year later. And at this trial, we were able to show and to bring more and more evidence to the court and to convince the judge. And the verdict came on May 2008. And on May 2008, the judge said I was not guilty of defamation. I still have the right to say wherever I want that friends to broadcast a fake news report, a blood libel.
And so this, basically, your case was handled on appeal.
Yeah.
And you were able to win on appeal in the case against France 2.
Exactly, against France 2 and the French journalist, French Israeli journalist Charles Enderlin.
Okay. Now, what is the status of that case? Have you been afforded restitution?
No. So, well, just that you know, after I won this trial, six days later,
mm-hmm.
Le Nouvel Observateur, which is the largest French weekly, plus Le Monde, which is the largest daily,
mm-hmm.
plus another weekly, issued a petition saying that the French judicial system doesn't work anymore. It was signed by 500 journalists, by some intellectuals in France, and saying that it was very shocking that someone like me, who's kind of a revisionist, could win a trial against such a great journalist like Charles Enderlin. So it was a complete ridiculous petition, but they were able to gather names and to publish it in the French newspapers. So I was really shocked. And just a few days later, France 2 appealed to the French Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
It was more than two years ago. And even though they appealed to the Supreme Court, we still don't have the verdict. So it's really something which is under a huge, political pressure and intervention, because we still don't have the verdict of the French Supreme Court, which will not rule about the fact that is it right or wrong that it's a hoax, but they will just rule and decide if I was right if the laws that which were used on a technical point of view were used properly. You know, it's a very technical point of view from
mm-hmm.
the judges.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with the truth or not the truth.
So basically, you won on appeal, but once again, Enderlin and France 2 have appealed to the highest court, the French Supreme Court, and their ruling will be made on the basis of whether or not the statutes under which you were sued represent a valid application of law, which is different from whether or not Mohamed Al-Dura was actually shot and killed in what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay,
so
just
it's something. It's a technical point. I insist on that. It's
sure.
technical. It has nothing to do with the truth, and maybe something I've not stressed enough is how we can prove it's a hoax. I mean, maybe if you don't mind, I'd like to insist on how easy it is to show it's a hoax. You know?
Actually, that's something I'd like to go into at considerable length. And by the way, Philippe, we have we have about 10 minutes left in this first half hour of the interview, the first half of the interview. I want to go into the evidence at considerable length, and we have to bear in mind that visual evidence, this is radio, so we won't be able to present in quite the same way. But yes, I want to go into that at great length because I think that's important. But I'd like to backtrack. And again, I want to apologize if some of these little interruptions seem tasteless to you. But you mentioned some signatories to a letter, basically, that was presented, or a petition. You mentioned Nouvel Observatoire Le Monde, and I believe a third publication. Le Parisien, explain, bearing in mind, again, the youth of much of the audience, and also the fact that generally Americans are not familiar with the French media and social/political landscape, because when you talk about those publications and those individuals, this is not a small consideration, and given their significance in suppressing truth in this case, it's important.
Well, I think it's very important to understand that they are the largest newspapers, most of the intellectuals signed this petition, and they say that I was kind of the Holocaust denier, you know. And it was unacceptable to see a Holocaust denier winning a trial against such a great journalist as the guy who made the blood libel. So this is exactly what we were. I mean, the world is completely upside down. I mean, the good guy, who I am, is accused of being a Holocaust denier, and the bad guy, the guy who is really defaming the Jews, defaming the Western world, is defended by the French journalist. It's really shocking.
There's actually a passage from Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography and political manifesto, that says that most people tell little lies. They would be ashamed to tell big lies. They would never credit others with such great impudence as the complete reversal of facts. And then the passage goes on to describe various aspects of that. But yes, the big lie is something that is very, it's in all honest error, in all consideration of some of these individuals, it's very difficult for a lot of people to even conceive of. And then beyond that, as Upton Sinclair, an American author and social critic, said, it's very difficult to get a person to believe something when retaining their job depends on their not believing it.
Yeah, I agree.
All right.
Yes, I agree.
Now, some of the details, perhaps, Philippe, and we'll go well into this next side if we need to. Okay, we've got Mohammed Al-Dura, young boy cowering behind I believe it was sort of a concrete barrier with his father. He's killed in cold blood, and his father wounded by the Israeli Defense Forces. This case becomes emblematic. It helps to fuel the rage of the Second Intifada. It's used as a recruiting tool by Osama bin Laden. It's used as the justification for killing Daniel Pearl, and in general becomes a huge cultural and political icon in the Muslim world. You win an appellate court decision saying that it was a hoax. How are people to grasp the physical evidence, bearing in mind that that the original presentation was on television and we're on radio?
Yeah. Well, it's quite easy to understand why it's a hoax, and I mean, now it's more and more easy. It's easier. You know, you take the last picture of the film. You can see the boy and the father, supposedly dead for the boy and wounded by the for the father. The claims of the French public TV that the boy got 3 bullets and was killed, and that the father got 12 bullets and was wounded. There is a huge problem, is that after these 15 bullets altogether, there is not a single drop of blood on their bodies, T-shirts, or on the wall. Doesn't make sense to any guy who's been involved in ballistics, you know. Moreover, we have, for example, the 10 following seconds after the boy was killed, naturally killed. What we can see is that in these 10 following seconds, the boy raises his elbow, looks at the cameraman, puts down his elbow, and leaves his foot up, which is impossible, you know, for any medical doctor. When you're dead, you're dead. You don't look at the cameraman, and you're bleeding, you know. So we have, these are the two main evidence, but we have more than 100 evidence of the hoax, of the invention of this scene. And all the scenes which were before and after, we can see that they're preparated and that they're manipulation. We can see, for example, that when the boy and the father are supposedly hiding behind the barrel, you can see guys smoking their cigarettes very close to them, and having fun, discussing, you know. So the scene is completely absurd, and we could gather this evidence only by buying other raw material, like AP, Reuters, who were filming the same day at the same spot.
So in other words, the cameraman whose work ultimately found its way onto the France 2 broadcast and whose work became the Aldura emblematic incident was only one of the filmers, other news agencies had filmers on the scene who showed, among other things, aside from the contradictions in the physical evidence of where the bullets were coming from, that there were people hanging around right beside where the people who were supposedly under fire, very casually smoking cigarettes and passing the time of day.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, and none of the other cameramen who were there were taking care and were paying attention to the boy and the father. I mean, they were supposedly the most important picture to take this day, but they were filming people smoking around, you know, so it doesn't make sense. You can even see that in the middle of the scene, there's a cameraman with his tripod filming in front of the Israeli compound when the guys are shooting at the boy and the father. That makes sense. I mean, if the soldiers were trying to shoot everybody, to kill everybody, I mean, they could have shot at these guys from the with the tripod, you know. So everything is ridiculous. It's real common sense. You know, I'm not, it's not rocket science. You know, it's really common sense. It's obvious. But it's so deep into French conscience that the Jews are killing, that the Jews are killers, that the Jews are the bad guys, that they were really to accept this version of the fact, which is horrible.
And the we'll review some of the forensic evidence on the other side. The number of wounds supposedly received were Mohamed Aldura, the child, was supposedly wounded three times. And again, these rounds are from Israeli Defense Force shoulder arms. That's an M16 rifle, a 223 round, supposedly three caliber 223 rounds, or 223 millimeter rounds, excuse me, struck Mohamed Aldura, and 12 223 rounds hit his father. So a total of 15 wounds inflicted. Listeners who would like to get a visual evaluation of this, there is a video about Pallywood that's available on the internet. Do you know, Philippe, what the formal title of that is?
No.
Is it? It's called Pallywood. Anyway, some of this is available on the internet, showing some of the outtake footage, including the footage where Mohamed Aldura raises the allegedly fatally.
You can Google Pallywood or Richard Landis. You know, Richard Landis worked extensively on that, and you can Google and find his website, The Audience Table, and you could find the films, and it's very interesting. I mean, it's an amazing picture because it's such a historical picture, but such a big nonsense, a big lie.
Well, what is interesting is you can see Mohamed Aldura supposedly hit three times. I didn't realize supposedly hit three times. There's no blood, and he raises his hand, looks at the camera, and then lays his head down. And even if he had not formally expired, he would have been in shock at that point. And again, there's no blood and a great many other contradictions as well. Philippe, for those who would like to contact you or access via the internet some of the information that you've developed, do you have a website, or does the organization
and/or? My website, even if it's not completely up to date because we had to work on it recently, but I can give you, the website is very easy because I had many of them, but the easiest I found is myname.fr, which is carsenty.fr, carsenty.fr. And if your listeners want to reach me, my email is very simple. It's Philippe, my first name, Philippe, @carsenty.fr.
Very good. And we have been speaking with Philippe Carsenty, and we're going to be speaking with Philippe Carsenty on side two of this interview. However, this concludes side one of For the Record program number 719, interview with Philippe Carsenty about the Mohamed Aldura case. This program is being recorded on July 25th of the year 2010. For Philippe Carsenty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.